The Angie's List you know and trust is now Angie, and we're so much more than just a list. We still connect you with top local pros and show you ratings and reviews, but now we also let you compare upfront prices on hundreds of projects and book a service instantly. We can even handle the rest of your project from start to finish. So remember, Angie's List is now Angie, and we're here to get your job done right. Get started at Angie.com. That's A-N-G-I, or download the app today.
Delve into the shadows of the mind with Sleeping Dogs, a gripping murder mystery starring Academy Award winner Russell Crowe. Now available on digital. Crowe portrays an ex-homicide detective unraveling a brutal murder he can't recall. Uncovering secrets from his past, he learns a chilling truth. It's best to let sleeping dogs lie. Visit sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery to watch Sleeping Dogs, now on digital. That's sleepingdogsmovie.com/wondery.
Fill her up.
You're listening to the Gas Digital Network.
We need to roll back the state. We spy on all of our own citizens.
Our prisons are flooded with nonviolent drug offenders.
If you want to know who America's next enemy is, look at who we're funding right now. Every single one of these problems are a result of government being way too big.
You're listening to Part of the Problem on the Gas Digital Network. Here's your host, Dave Smith.
Hey, what's up, everybody? Welcome to a brand new episode of Part of the Problem. I'm very excited to have our guest for today's show, one of my favorite guys in this Liberty space that I just recently discovered. And I love it. It warms my heart when I discover new libertarian commentators who I'm like, oh, yes, this guy's nailing it. Of course, it is Clint from the Liberty Lockdown podcast, blowing up in the libertarian space left and right. What's up, my brother? How you doing?
I'm good, Dave. Thanks so much for having me on. This is very exciting for me.
Oh, great, great. Well, very happy to have you on. Some of you guys might know I just recently did Clint's show. So go check that out. If you haven't already, check out all his other podcasts. And he's all over making the circuit in these spaces. So for people who aren't familiar with you, tell my audience a little bit about yourself. Like, how did you become a libertarian? What led you to start this show that obviously is kind of centered around the lockdowns? So, a little bit of background.
Sure. I'm a rarity in that I'm a second-gen libertarian. My dad was actually, he ran for Congress as a libertarian in the 90s in Carlsbad in San Diego County area. And he was a private money mortgage broker when I was growing up. So he taught me the trade. I worked for him, and then I started my own company about 8 years ago. And let's put my phone on mute and pretend like I'm a professional here. So I started my own company about 8 years ago, found a lot of success, was killing it, very happy with life, and then the lockdowns happened. And simultaneously, the LP basically just failed me in terms of messaging, just to be blunt. You know, they didn't push back. It seemed as if they were waiting to see how bad this virus was. And I was like, that's not what the Party of Freedom does. You know, you don't wait to see how bad this crisis is before you decide whether or not people are locked in their fucking houses. So when they didn't message very aggressively on that, I remember very specifically the day that the lockdowns were announced in San Diego. I walked to the beach and I sat there because I knew that the beaches were going to be closed the next day. And I just kind of meditated on it. And I was like, what am I going to do? Like, this is truly dystopic stuff that's coming down. And basically at that moment, I just decided, I was like, all right, well, I'll do a podcast. I mean, that's like the least I could do. And then, thank God I had a little bit of a Twitter following that helped to get the ball rolling. And less than a year later, and I'm talking to the guy that inspired me to get going. So it's crazy.
Yeah, well, you've been killing it, man, and the success is a result of that. I think that you know, we were talking just for a minute before we started about some of the arguments with all the bitch libertarians that I get into on Twitter. But you know, like, one of the common themes, and this is true of not just like kind of It's true with a lot of the kind of like woke obsessed people. It's true with some of the socialist obsessed people who blame capitalism for it. None of them are ever impressive. You know, it's just like, and that's one of the things that you can't get away from. I mean, there are people who I've had, you know, differences with who are impressive. There's a lot of them, but you don't see them acting like deranged maniacs. You know what I mean? Like it's a very, you know, like Spike Cohen, for example, right? Me and him certainly have some disagreements here and there, but you can't deny Spike's an impressive guy. Whatever you think about him, I mean, the guy is, I mean, he's pretty young. He was the VP candidate for the Libertarian Party. He's built up a big following. You know, you notice when you have disagreements. Anyway, the point is, the reason you're doing well is because you've got talent at this, and I'm glad you're doing it. So to what you said about obviously this is something that we're in agreement about, that the Libertarian Party messaging on the lockdowns was just, I mean, it was tragic. It was tragic. It was their moment handed to them in a year when they had a presidential campaign. I mean, this is it. The governors are out there just telling you, yeah, we've repealed the Bill of Rights and we're locking Americans in their homes. And this was your, it was like a layup. It was so easy to just say, oh, you don't have the right to do that. That's all. Yeah. I mean, there was one tweet that the National Party shared that during this whole mess, I think eventually, like within the last month, they came out against the lockdowns. Like, thank you. Now that we've been locked down for a year. Okay. Thank you for being against them. But there was one tweet over the last year that they shared where they were like, you know, the government doesn't have a right to deem some people essential and non-essential. That being said, it's a really good idea to wear your mask and stay 6 feet apart and all this. And it's like, could we just get one standalone tweet? Something just condemning the lockdowns. How hard can that be for a libertarian to be against blatant government tyranny?
You would think it's kind of, I mean, like you said, it's a layup. It was a layup. They were offered a gift. I mean, a gift in the form of tyrannical nonsense, but a gift nonetheless. You know, like when the state is fucking up, that is the opportunity for the LP or any third party for that matter to say, hey, maybe we have a different path that we should be taking. Maybe we should consider you know, our rights. Hey, what a concept. Consider our rights. We're free people. And it really did seem to me like they were waiting to see, is this thing the bubonic plague? You know, is it that dangerous that we really ought to be staying in our houses for a year until this thing passes? And my point all along, even though I ended up being very much right that it was not nearly as dangerous as we had initially been propagandized to believe it was that it doesn't matter how dangerous it is. You advise free people on how to behave, and then they can decide if they want to or not. You do not mandate. You do not instruct. We are free. Like, I didn't think that was a revolutionary take, but if you looked at the LP Twitter account, it seems to be. And it created a void for people like me and you and others to get our voices out there and say, hey, regardless of what the LP has to say, there are libertarians that actually believe in the Bill of Rights, and they believe that we are a free, you know, people. So that's really all I was about for the first 3-4 months. And then my show kind of evolved into talking about the mortgage crisis because of, I don't even know if I mentioned, but that was what my business was a private money mortgage lender. So not a bank, but a private money mortgage lender. So.
Right. Okay. So I want to get into some of the stuff in the housing industry and get your perspective on all that. But I just, you know, to back up what you were saying, because I just think it's such an important thing. And I don't, you know, I'm really not like harping on this just to, you know, dunk on the Libertarian Party or to get a win on them. It's that it's that damn important to understand what happened here and how big an opportunity this was and how much it was blown. And that, you know, Jeff Deist said a thing on my show, and I think he said this elsewhere as well, but it always really stuck with me as such an excellent observation, is that he was like, you know, when the left talks about things, they're serious. And when the Republicans talk about things, everyone knows they're not serious. Mm-hmm. You know, the Republicans could say something about how, like, we should ban, you know, abortion in this country. No one thinks there's a serious move to ban abortion. No one's even worried about it. Even the people on the left are just pretending to be worried about it. They know there's no chance that they're making moves. But when the left says they want something, they mean it. You know, like now it will be perverted and taken over by corporate interests and things like that. But they're serious about what they stand for. And I think that by libertarians not standing against the lockdowns, it was a subconscious message to a lot of people that they're not serious. They're not serious about opposing the government. They're not serious about it. You know, you're sending out tweets about civil asset forfeiture in the middle of a government lockdown. And it's like, what? This is just, come on, man. I mean, we're all against civil asset forfeiture, but come on. Like, what are you talking about here? If you're not seriously ready to put up some opposition against this, then no one's going to take you seriously because you don't really mean it. And that's transparent.
And when I was on Free Men Beyond the Wall with Pete, that's exactly what we talked about. Is like, he and I now are at the point where we're so radicalized, we get pissed when we see a libertarian account online that just says like hashtag taxation is theft. It's like, you've been locked in your house for 12 months. Are you concerned about taxes right now? Yeah. Like, is that really the priority? Is that really the major threat to our liberty right now in this moment? Of course we're opposed to taxes. And of course taxation is theft, but that is not what we're concerned with right now. Until we get our basic freedoms back, nothing else matters. And that's why I named my show what I did. It was like, this is the biggest infringement on our rights in my lifetime. I mean, it might be the biggest in 100 years. It's really, really bad. And it just seemed as if that was not being messaged. And I really don't want to focus on the LP because ultimately, what power did they have? Had they messaged correctly, it's not like the lockdowns would have ended, right?
Sure.
So this is bigger than that. And I think that it's bigger than that for people that aren't even in the LP. You know, even the conservatives that are opposed to lockdowns. It's incumbent upon anybody that opposes these lockdowns to speak up because so many people are afraid. Even though if you talk to people, 90% of people are on board with what you and I think about this stuff. I mean, they're not excited or happy about continuing to lose their jobs and have no friends and not be able to hug their dying grandmother. Like, this is really important stuff. And there is way more people out there that agree with us. And if we just inspire them to have the courage to say it, we might actually stop this. And that's kind of what I've been about.
Yeah, no, I completely agree. Completely agree with all of that stuff. And it's just, it's important to realize going forward, right? Because let's like be constructive about this and what, you know, is in the past is over, I guess. But what's important is that you have to stand for principles in the moment when it's the most difficult to do so. Yep. Because that's what inspires other people, and that's what lets them know that you are serious about this and that it's not just an abstraction. Unless, you know, I stand for liberty, like give me liberty or give me death. It's like, well, right now it might be a little bit dangerous to stand for liberty. It's like, okay, well, then we'll see. We'll see what happens. But, you know, in the abstract, give me liberty or give me death. Like, no, you have to stand.
But most importantly, don't give me death. Don't give me death, please.
Well, I remember seeing the thing to me that was the first sign of how scary this whole thing was. And it was during the 15 days. And I remember talking about this on my podcast at the time. So this is literally, it's the week that, you know, or within the 2 weeks of when it went from like, oh shit, Italy is shut down. Oh shit, the NBA just canceled their season. Oh man, do you think we'll have some type of lockdowns here? Oh, everything shut down. Like it had just happened. Like everything was shut down. They were calling it a shelter in place order in New York City, or at least the mayor called it that. The governor was left. But so it was Cuomo who at the time, you know, it's almost hard to remember now that he's such a fallen, you know, like figure, but not grandma killer, not ass pincher, but just hero, god, emperor, governor Cuomo. And he was having one of these press conferences and it was like the lockdowns were brand new. They were a few days old, you know, so he was just explaining how this was going to work. And one of the reporters, in a very not aggressive way at all, but just kind of like throughout, he goes, was asking about the prisons. And then they were like, well, what about the people who are waiting to stand trial? You know, are they going to have like, you know, like what about a speedy trial for them? How long are you going to put that off? And Cuomo just turned it over to one of his other people who were at the press conference. And she goes, we're going to delay the trials because our concern is just that if we were to rush these trials now with all the lockdowns and everything, then it might lead to people just not being able to prepare their case and blah, 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 that. So we'll just, you know, we're just going to abolish the right to a speedy trial. And everyone's just like, okay, yeah. And we were about like 5 days into this thing where I just went, whoa, this is it. Like, this is the one. This is the government sitting there telling you, oh, yeah, I know the whole Bill of Rights thing and the constitutionally protected right. But, you know, virus. So, nah, that's it. All that's gone. And this was a month before Governor Murphy in New Jersey went on Tucker Carlson and just flat out said, We're not thinking about the Bill of Rights. That's above my pay grade. And yeah. So that's just like, you know, for the next time when you see signs like that, that's the time to start screaming at the top of your lungs about how evil this is. And that's the thing that's going to make the liberty movement relevant in real people's lives. That's what's going to make people not be able to laugh us off as libertarians or whatever, because, oh no, we're actually dealing with the crisis that's right in front of you in a courageous way. So anyway, that's what you're doing with this show. And that's why people are attracted to it.
Well, wasn't that, I think you brought it up a few times, wasn't it Harry Brown that wrote the article on September 12th, 2001?
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
I mean, that's the type of courageous act that we need. You know, we need people that aren't going to read the political tea leaves and decide what their belief system is in that moment. Like, our principles are above and beyond the day-to-day news. It's like, this is what's happening now. Is this against my principles or isn't it? And if the answer is it's against it, it's incumbent upon you to talk. It's incumbent upon you to speak up and defend people's rights, especially during crisis when no one has the courage to do it. That's when it's most important that you actually show your principles. And if you're unwilling, it's just cowardice. So I'm glad that
that's exactly it. And it's specifically it's a fear in many and this exists a lot within libertarians and within not just libertarians, within left wing and right wing radicals as well. But there's a fear of being demonized by the cathedral. And that's, you know, I had one of these, you know, bitch libertarians who gives me shit the other day was just saying, he had this whole long post about how if, you know, if the Mises Caucus and if Dave Smith are allowed to dominate the party, then what do you think the media is going to do to him? They're going to tear him apart for having Nick Fuentes on his show or something like this, right? And it's like, dude, so you're operating out of fear of the corporate press slandering us. They're going to. If we ever succeed, they're going to. What do you think? Like, if a serious movement that was serious about abolishing the Federal Reserve and scaling back the military-industrial complex ever rose up, but they didn't have Nick Fuentes on their show, they'd go, well, we got nothing. We got nothing to say about him now. You know, we're not.
They slandered Ron Paul.
Yes, they will call the most, the kindest country doctor a bigot if they you know, so that's just almost like, if you are opposed to the establishment, forget even libertarian, if you're anything that's opposed to the establishment, you have to be willing to let go of the fear that you're going to get called names. You're going to, if you are effective at all, you're going to. There is not a single effective anti-establishment leader or movement that will not get demonized with all of this stuff. So accept that, that's baked into the price, and move forward.
Yeah, and accept the fact that if you want to change the most tyrannical, largest state in history, in human history at this point, I mean, maybe not the most tyrannical, but certainly the largest, you're going to have to risk something. It's not going to be easy. So, like, especially for the Libertarian Party, especially for the people that call themselves libertarians or God forbid, anarchists, that are operating out of fear when it comes to the cathedral or, you know, the hit pieces that might come out, that you might have to get a new job. Like, the only reason that they have power is because we're afraid of them, because we all try and play this game, because we all try and, you know, watch what we say and, you know, reframe what we're saying and just basically be bitches about it. Like, you've described it multiple times. It's like, if we were to all have courage, this whole bullshit cancel culture stuff stops. And I really believe that. I believe that the majority of this country still don't believe in cancel culture. Most of them hate it. I mean, there's polls that say exactly that. But the reason it has power is because we're all afraid to stand up.
Yeah.
So because I'm in a position of financial freedom, because I'm, like, basically, you know, retired in my late 30s, I don't have a family either. I have no excuse. Like, this is all about risking my own, you know, name. I don't have anybody else to look after, other than, obviously, I'd like to look after my parents to some extent. but because I'm in such a blessed position, I really felt like, okay, well, everybody else is afraid. I'm just going to go for it. And if I get canceled, you know, who gives a fuck? Right. I have a life outside of this. And if they try and ruin me, then so be it. These are principles that are bigger than that, in my opinion.
Yeah. Yeah. Amen. Hey guys, let's take a quick second. I want to thank our sponsor for today's show, which is iTrust Capital. This is the best place to invest in physical gold and crypto. iTrust Capital. I think everyone in our audience is interested in investing in gold and crypto. We've seen how much money the Fed has been printing over the last years, and this is a great way to protect yourself. Now, if you're interested in investing in gold and crypto, iTrust Capital is the place to do it, and here's why. All iTrust accounts are IRAs, which means you can invest and trade your crypto and gold tax-free on their 24/7 platform. If you have an existing IRA or other retirement accounts like a 401k, you can roll those over with no penalties and no taxes. iTrust Capital makes investing in crypto safe and easy. You can log into your account 24/7 and invest at the push of a button. Now crypto can be traded as easily as stocks. No keys, no complex process. iTrust Capital also makes investing in physical gold easy. iTrust uses a blockchain ledger that gives you digital ownership of physical gold held at the Royal Canadian Mint. So it's not a security or a derivative or some financial construct. This is fully backed by physical gold that's deliverable upon request. And the best part, iTrust Capital has low transparent pricing that's 90% cheaper than their competitors. So if you're looking for an IRA to trade crypto or gold tax-free, go to itrustcapital.com, use the promo code POTP, and your first month will be free. One more time, that's itrustcapital.com, promo code POTP for your first month free. Also, if you're interested in learning more about iTrust Capital, I recorded a short conversation with the CEO of the company that I posted on the Gas Digital sponsor page. itrustcapital.com, promo code POTP. All right, let's get back into the show. You know, you're right with the cancel culture thing. It's unbelievable where you see, like, even, you know, when Bill Maher or someone like that will be railing against cancel culture and his entire liberal audience is just cheering. Like, you can tell they all really hate this thing. Yet the momentum of it just keeps going. And there's so much corporate, you know, like weight thrown into it that it's kind of like the inertia of it is taking over at this point. But so that's exactly right. It's not enough for everyone to just kind of passively be like, oh, we don't like this. It's like, no, a stand needs to be made. We're not doing this anymore. We're not canceling somebody because somebody else had a Halloween costume and they didn't call them out for that Halloween costume. Like, this is beyond, first off, it's just stupid. It's just really, really dumb. And also incredibly dangerous. It's like, what type of, like, North Korea type society are you trying to turn us into, where we're all scared of being ratted out by our neighbor for, you know, it's just, it needs to be forcefully, you know, rejected. And it takes some courage to do that.
Yeah. I think that, you know, it's whoever has the ability out there. I mean, even if you have to risk something, like, do you want, basically just ask yourself, do you want your kids to be raised in a society like this? Like, and if the answer is no, how about you do something about it? Like, now, no one enjoys this. This doesn't feel good. This is not the American way. So if you value American principles, have some fucking courage and talk about it. Talk to your neighbors. You'll find out that most of them don't agree with this stuff either. And if you realize then that we're being ruled by a tyrannical minority, and a very small one, in my opinion, of the people that are true cancel culture zealots, then just realize that we don't have to play this game anymore. And I know I'm kind of preaching to the choir here, but it's true. I mean, we don't have to do this. We don't have to be this way. And I don't agree with the conservative principle of, you know, fighting the same game and trying to cancel them when they, oh, they're a hypocrite. Oh, we caught them here. Oh, you know, this reporter said something about Asians, you know, 10 years before she canceled someone for saying something about Asian people. Who gives a shit? I really don't want to go down that path. I want to cease this cycle of cannibalism. And that's really what it is. I mean, we are eating each other. And I mean, this is the reason that I'm so concerned that we are falling down a Marxist path, is because it has all of the signs of, like, this is, they sow division, they make us eat each other. And I just don't, I'm unwilling to participate. I'm not going to cancel people, and I'm also not going to be canceled. Deal with it.
You know? No, I think that's the right attitude to have. All right. So I want to talk about the stuff that's going on in the housing industry, because I know you have kind of like a particularly unique insight to this, because you were in that industry. So what is it that, like, what were the things that you were noticing at first with the lockdowns, how they've affected this entire industry? Where do you think we are now? What do you see coming in the future? Let's jump into it.
Yeah. So Well, let me explain briefly what I do so that why it's different. My company was a private money lender, which means that I use private investor capital, you know, wealthy or semi-wealthy, either retired people or working age people. They give me their money. I broker it out to a private lender. So it's not, I'm not a bank. You know, I don't get money from the Fed. I'm like OG banking is how I describe it. Like what banking was supposed to be.
Right.
And we lend at a higher interest rate because it's real people's money and they expect an actual return on their money as opposed to, you know, 3%, which that risk makes no sense at all. So that's what I do. So I had a really good sense of how real estate works, how risk works, how to evaluate collateral, which is the property, and things like that. So when the lockdowns happen, obviously I'm thinking to myself, okay, I need to reassess my risk before I proceed with doing any future loans. So I look at the lockdowns and I'm like, okay, we have how many people are going to be put out of work by this? I mean, right away, you have to think that that's going to be a huge problem for the real estate market. If it's not tenants that can't pay their rent, it's owners that can't pay their mortgages, whatever comes of this, you're going to see significant evictions. And if you see evictions, you'll see foreclosures, sure enough. So at the time, basically, I decided I'm not going to do any loans. Like it, even though I wasn't technically put out of business since I work from home, I was like, I can't in good conscience as a fiduciary to my lenders, my investors, I can't continue down this path. So I had to stop lending. Unfortunately or fortunately, depending on how you look at it, the Fed and the government decided to paper this over in a way that I never thought possible. I mean, they just threw, I mean, the money printer burr hard. Like as hard as it can possibly burr. And that's, I mean, that's a fun way of, you know, talking about the $7 trillion that we've essentially printed or borrowed to paper over this disastrous policymaking. But because of that, it delayed the day of reckoning, exactly what the Fed always does. It kicked the can down the road. And I believe that at some point over the next 12 to 18 months, we will see the true, you know, price that we have to pay for these unbelievably stupid policies.
Yeah, it's such a good way to look at it. And in many ways, right, so like in 2008, and this is one of the things that's brilliant about the Fed system. Murray Rothbard talked about this back in the day, where he was like, oh, if you, you know, if the Federal Reserve, like if taxes go up, everyone goes, look, my taxes just went up. Like they mm-hmm. see it right in front of them. You feel it. Your more of your money has been taken away from you, you know? But when the Fed prints money, you know, it takes a few years for the inflation to kick in, and then they blame it on the speculators or this or that. It's very difficult to pinpoint it on, well, look, the government just took my money, even though that's exactly, in effect, what's happening. And in 2008, you know, here we had this financial disaster that was, you know, brought on by the housing crash. And what did they do? They printed a ton of money. They bailed out the big banks. We brought interest rates down to zero, all of these things to paper over it. And so you're like, well, what are the true costs of doing that? And the true costs of doing that are the state that America's in today.
Yes.
It's like everything. Like the true costs of that are Donald Trump being elected, the Antifa in the streets. Like all of this is the cost of what papering over that did. Yep. And it's hard to precisely explain that to people, but that's really the result of it. You know, it's all about the fact that you had this economic crisis. By bringing interest rates down to zero, created an entire economy that's based around the speculators and the politically connected and screws over the average person, anyone on a fixed income, anyone who is interested in perhaps saving some money. I mean, that's all. And there are huge economic and just societal consequences to doing things like that. And now we've entered into a new, even more extreme realm of that. And what the ramifications are going to be for this, like you said, they kicked the can down the road, but the costs are going to be enormous in however they manifest themselves.
Yeah.
But you think in the next 12 to 18 months, there's going to be some real problems in the housing industry. What do you, you know, obviously, you know, you're not a fortune teller, but what do you think that's going to look like?
Well, it's very hard to say because I can't predict when the government actually stops the foreclosure and eviction moratoriums. And that's the only reason that we're not paying the price already. I mean, well, that paired with unemployment insurance and PPP loans and stimulus checks just, you know, sent to people's bank accounts. So all of it has been delayed in such a deep way that I can't say definitively. Like, people always ask me for a timeline, and I'm like, I don't know. I don't know for sure, because Joe Biden could continue to do this. I mean, they could go to UBI. They could just hyperinflate this thing. Like, they could do whatever they want, basically. Their power is essentially unlimited, except for when it comes to economics. They will pay a price at some point via economics. And I think that if I'm right, that they will probably, because they want to preserve, you know, fiat's capacity. Let me get my phone off there. Because they want to preserve fiat's capacity to, you know, continue to function, I think that they will allow for a deflationary collapse at some point. That's my belief. Other people lean a different direction. They think that they will just hyperinflate us out of this and switch to a central bank digital currency. That's also a potential outcome. But if I'm right on the deflationary side, you should see a repeat of 08-09 where all assets, including the stock market, which I want to be very clear, I think real estate has more of an intrinsic value than the stock market does. But real estate is tied to interest rates in such a way that if you see an interest rate spike because people expect inflation, look out below, because we have record high interest rates or record low interest rates. So record high prices, record high capacity for borrowing, record high debt. I mean, this is all, like, I feel like I'm just standing in 2007 screaming, hey, you know what happened last time? You know, like, yeah. It's coming. So that's basically what I'm about, is trying to warn people and let them know that, you know, whether I'm right, either way, if it's deflationary, hyperinflationary, we're going to pay a price for this. You can prepare accordingly, and hopefully you and your family can benefit from it.
Yeah. What do you think? What would you say is the best way to prepare for it?
Well, other than, you know, storing cash, if you're, and I know this is a very anti-libertarian stance and people get very upset with me when I say it, but I honestly believe that because you exist in a culture that has so much debt, if you have the capacity to have what's called dry powder, the, you know, just free liquidity, free cash to go out and buy the depressed assets. What I did is I basically turned myself from a poor person into a rich person just by buying and flipping assets from like 2009 till today, you know, and I just crushed it. And the reason I was able to, I didn't even have that much cash. I was a broke kid. I was in my 20s, but I had really good credit, and I was able to go out and buy houses that I shouldn't have been able to afford. And I knew that because the Fed would start to print, that we would benefit from it. And sure enough, you know, most of my investments would, you know, 30, 40% after 3-4 years of holding. And you just do that a couple of times, you keep parlaying it, plus you're using leverage, you can really turn your life around. I basically went from a poor college student to retired in 10 years. So it's possible. And on the flip side, if you think that we're going the hyperinflationary route, certainly Bitcoin, I think long-term has the potential to replace fiat, but in the interim, if I'm right about the deflationary debt collapse, you should see a better entry point for Bitcoin. So that's kind of what I've been advising to people.
Okay. Yeah. No, that makes sense to me. All right, guys, let's take a moment and thank our sponsor for today's show, which is Fume. Fume is a great natural non-addictive replacement for smoking, vaping, and nicotine addictions. It's not a vape. It's not a cigarette. Fume is a hollow piece of Canadian maple with cores infused with the benefits of the world's super plant. Using Fume is a great replacement therapy, replacing the hand-to-mouth action of smoking or vaping. A number of their different flavors are great natural nicotine craving reducers as well. There's a wide selection of cores which focus on flavor, aroma, and the specific effects you're looking for. The newest, their Conquer Cores, are a deep cooling mix of earthly sweetness, a combination of black pepper for cravings, peppermint to help with breathing, and cinnamon and lavender to ease the pain of quitting. The Conquer are the number one cores for quitting smoking start to finish. All Fume items are manufactured and sustainably produced in Calgary, Alberta, Canada, with Canadian maple. Check out their website, fumeessential.com. That's FUMESSENTIAL.com. Take a look at their entire selection. There's more than half a dozen flavors. They explain the entire Fume program there. Go check it out, fumeessential.com. You can subscribe for monthly deliveries and never have to worry about your Fume supply, or you can check out their new products a la carte and find your favorite that way. Either way, make sure to use our promo code PROBLEM10. That'll get you 10% off your entire order at FumeEssential.com. Make sure to upgrade yourself in 2021. Go to FumeEssential.com and use the promo code PROBLEM10 for 10% off your entire order. All right, let's get back into it. It's been interesting around where I am, you know, like in the New York City and kind of outside New York City area. it's been real interesting to see some of the trends in real estate. So outside the city is like blowing up.
Yeah.
Like blowing up. Houses that were worth $300,000, $400,000 are going for $1 million now. Like really crazy numbers. And really, even more so than after 2008.
Yep.
The prices in New York City are actually dipping, which is like never happens. Never happens. Like in my lifetime, even in the real estate crash, they like maybe went down a tiny little bit and then just like tapered off. They weren't like accelerating quite as fast as they usually do.
But, oh, wow. I didn't know that.
Like prices in New York City have been dropping like 20-30%. Nothing, you know, not something that's like substantial, you know? Yeah. And so it's just been interesting to see that. You can get a real, you know, an apartment that would have been like $6,000 a month. You could go rent a place for like $4,500 a month now in Manhattan, which still sounds, you know, like not the greatest.
Still expensive.
Yeah, but for Manhattan, if you're kind of like aware of the nature of Manhattan real estate, that's really something. And it's and I wonder, you know, it's like aside from just the economic, you know, question, there's something about just like the human aspect of how things have been changed that so many people are now reconsidering the whole desire to live in a city. There's so many people on a mass level who are now going like, wait a minute, what are the advantages to a city again? City's kind of depressing now. And all the things that would draw you into a city aren't really there anymore. And the crime's up and the homeless are everywhere. And yeah, all of a sudden having a house and a yard seems a lot nicer.
Yeah. And I mean, the entire reason to live in a city is because of the events that you're able to do. And if you take those away, then you're like, oh, now all I see are the negatives of living in a city. I don't get to go to the opera or a play or to a restaurant or anything fun at all. I can't even hang out with my friends, for God's sake. So, yeah, of course you're going to flee the city. Why wouldn't you?
And in addition to that stuff, right, it's also the cities tend to be the Democrat strongholds.
True.
And they tend to be made up of the people who are buying into this stuff the most.
Right.
I mean,
right.
It's really like it's unbelievable. Like around here where I am, no one wears a mask outside. I shouldn't say no one. You'll see some older people who wear it occasionally.
Sure.
But pretty much no one wears a mask and no one's even thinking about it. You know, you kind of have to when you go into one of the stores, and then when you're out of there, you just don't. But in New York City, people are walking around. I mean, they look at you like you're crazy when you don't have a mask on. And you're like, dude, we're outside and we're 20 feet apart from each other.
Right.
It's like, get over this insanity. Like, stop. I had this 400-pound woman, like, giving me looks the other day in New York City walking around without a mask. And it's like, she's literally, I mean, like, I'd say 30 feet away from me. And you're like, I don't know what to tell you. Walk around me. It'll help you on many different levels, okay? Walk more.
I have a great story for you. That's a real quick one.
Sure.
I did an anti-lockdown protest back in like August or something. Mm-hmm. And I went down to Encinitas, which is a beautiful beach town. And there was probably like a dozen of us because, you know, everyone was concerned with Black Lives Matter rallies at that point, but no one was concerned with ending the, you know, unbelievable tyrannical government. I have no clue why. Anyways, that's a sidetrack. So I get there and we're hanging out, you know, holding our signs. It's like probably the first protest I've ever been to, because this is like I really got, you know, inspired during this period. And we're, you know, most of us aren't wearing masks. I mean, first off, it was early. So like I don't even think masks were required at that point. But secondarily, I wasn't afraid. I'm a young, healthy guy who exercises constantly. And I was like, I'm not worried about this thing. I already know enough to know that that's not an issue. And this guy goes, by the way, it's on the 101, which is like the biggest thoroughfare for bike riding and running and jogging and things like that. And it's the most beautiful irony I've ever seen in my life. This guy, this really healthy guy, shirt off, runs past me, running with two masks on, turns to me and says, "You fucking idiot." I just couldn't help but laugh. Like normally if someone says that to me, a stranger, I'd be like, all right, we're fighting. But this guy, he's wearing two masks and he's running. I'm like, who's the idiot, bro? Like,
dude, do you see that? It's I think literally my favorite meme of all time. But just the meme of the person who's going, you know, I think there might be a bigger plot behind this or whatever. I forget the exact line. But she's like, I think there might be a hidden plot behind all of this. And then there's the person in like the hazmat suit who goes, I think you're being a little paranoid. It's just the greatest, like just captures everything about the last year. I was talking to this guy who's like a younger kid. He's like 25 years old. Just talking to him after an event recently. And he was talking about how, you know, like playing people that he was at this park where there's like basketball courts. And that they say at the park, you have to keep your mask on, stay 6 feet apart, and you're not supposed to play games. They say you can do drills, but you can't play games. And he was saying that basically, like, no one's listening to them, that they're playing games, you know? And that he said some people are playing with their masks on, but they're playing pickup games. And I was trying to break it down to him where I was like, look, okay, I'll remove the fact of, like, you're concerned about older people in your life, or if you have someone in your life who is like seriously immunocompromised in some way, right? Like remove just that from the equation. I was saying, if you are, this is a healthy young 25-year-old. I go, if you are putting a mask on to play basketball out of any concern for yourself, it's as ridiculous as it would have been to play basketball with a mask on any other time in life.
Yeah, exactly.
Like you're that guy. If you're doing this, it's just as crazy as in 2010 showing up to the basketball court and going, you guys mind if I just mask up real quick first? I'm just, you know, I'm worried about, you know, colds and all, you know, like this will be, if you get this, it will be a cold for you.
Right.
That's what you're worried about. It's a cold. Like there is you, it's, it's less dangerous than the flu in terms of if you got the flu, the odds that you'd be sick are higher. Like you could get this and just have no symptoms. Basically, there's a pretty decent chance of that.
Yeah.
So it's just that. And it's almost like just for people to at least have that mentality, like this is as crazy as this always would have been to be doing what you're doing.
That's
right,
such
now.
A great way to frame it, because it really forces you to remember the before.
Yes.
Right. The before time when we had freedom and, you know, we hugged people and we saw our grandparents before they died. Yeah, I think that's a great way to frame it, because it reminds people this isn't normal. This isn't how we live. It doesn't even make sense. It's not even rational. I mean, masks, for the love of God, playing sports, like aerobic sports where you have to breathe and you're impinging that capacity is so it's dangerous. It's genuinely dangerous. Like I'm sure we have people, kids that are fainting and things like that. One of my friends is a teacher at an elementary school, and she's thinking about quitting because they are forcing these children to wear masks all the time, and it's breaking her heart. And I don't blame her. These kids aren't even in danger, man. You know it. I don't understand it for the life of me. I can't understand how parents of all people are not putting a stop to this. I mean, for yourself, sure. I mean, if you want to be an idiot and wear a mask forever, okay. But your kids, man, come on. Like, we have to have more courage than this.
It's the most, to me, the most profoundly disturbing aspect of all of the last year is what people, how much we're willing to sacrifice from children's lives. And I'm, you know, I guess I'm lucky in the sense that my daughter is young and not in school yet, and we haven't had to deal with any of this stuff, because I ask myself sometimes, like, whoa, what would I do in this situation? But it wouldn't be sending them to a masked up environment. But the idea is that, okay, so we've got this conclusive science at this point that these children are not at risk. They're not at risk of spreading it to each other. They're not at risk of getting sick from this virus. They're not at risk at all of anything bad happening in any statistically meaningful sense. You know, like just nothing there. But they go, well, it might be theoretically some risk to an older immunocompromised teacher. And you're like, okay, so for that, you are willing to literally muzzle every single child in this country? We're going to muzzle them and make them, you know, like
as opposed to quarantining those that are at risk. The thing we should have done from the beginning, the thing that we've always done historically, is that you try and remove the people that are actually at risk to the virus from society.
Yes. Or, you know, right. I mean, I'm completely fine with that. Or how about you take the fucking risk?
Or
like,
that.
I'm sorry. I mean, like, people have jobs that require risk. And that's like, I mean, hey, you have the right to quit that job if this isn't the risk that you signed
100%.
Up for. Yeah. But, you know, it's like people go out and are, you know, war reporters and they get kidnapped by ISIS, you know, like things happen. Like there are risky jobs out there. Okay. And if we're saying right now that you're a teacher and the question is, should a very, very small percentage of teachers take a pretty small risk? Or we should rob from the development and the freedom and the quality of life from all of the children. This isn't even like a conversation that needs to be had from me. Right. This is the easiest answer that you could think of. It's like, yeah. No, we put the children first. It's what any moral society would do. Mm-hmm. Put the children first.
Yeah. And that's probably why that's why I harp on the lockdown so much, is because of the damage that's happening to the next generation. I mean, I'll try and white pill us here, in that my hope is that instead of crippling the next generation, all these kids that are being raised to fear smiling faces and to fear hugs and to fear touch, you know, basic human needs, by the way. My hope is that it creates a countercultural revolution against the oppressive state. My fear is that it creates an acceptance of it. So that story is yet to be told. I don't know which direction it goes.
Yeah, well, in the spirit of white pilling, right? Here's the case for optimism, and I'll go back to the great Murray Rothbard. So he gave this whole speech about it. It's up on YouTube somewhere, you can find it. But he gave this speech right after the Soviet Union collapsed, which Murray Rothbard, you know, it's really a shame that he died, you know, fairly young. And it would have been great to have more of his work out there. But he did live long enough to see the Soviet Union collapse. And that is
that's pretty cool.
Yeah, that's pretty awesome. If you could imagine, you know, Murray Rothbard was like, he writes a lot about how he was, you know, like when he was growing up in like the 30s and 40s as a Jew in New York, everyone were like communists except him and his dad. Mm-hmm. Like he was like the only ones who weren't in that. And they were the ones just like preaching against this. And to watch that, like the whole arc of it, and then see it fall apart. But Rothbard was talking about how many thinkers had basically accepted the idea that the Soviet Union had created the new socialist man, and that through decades and decades of brutal state power and brutal state propaganda, they had convinced people that they no longer had their individual identities, their nationalistic identities, that they no longer, you know, like that they had so demonized any type of self-interest or desire for, you know, freedom or better things in life or anything like that. And so, you know, beat them down into this collectivist mindset. And they were wrong. They were dead wrong. Even after, you know, whatever, 70 years of brutal oppression, when given the chance, that human spirit rose right back up, and they did not want to be a part of this whole thing. And so,
gave me chills.
Yeah, I mean, look, you could say that the fact that some of these kids are growing up with all of these incredible, you know, these totalitarian rules and regulations, and you must do this, and you must not do that, and you must wear this mask, and stay away from this person, and be afraid of this. It's never count out the human spirit. That they might at some point just say, how, like, this might actually backfire and lead to a desire for freedom, a desire for them to be like, no, fuck that. What type of life is this? Mm-hmm. Like, this is, and that's been a big thing that Tom Woods talked a lot about over this last year. Like, just this really basic, like, inherent philosophical thought of, like, what does it mean to live? Mm-hmm. It doesn't just mean to not die.
Yes.
Like it means, like, you know what I mean? Like if you could live in some tube where you couldn't move or think or do anything, but they would keep your heart beating and food pumping in through a feeding tube to you, and that, and be like, oh, look, you lived another 80 years. Like that's indistinguishable from dying. That means nothing.
In some ways it's worse.
Yes. Yeah. I think you'd rather die. And I wonder if maybe, you know, at some point our generation and the younger generation will wake up to that and go, you know what? We want to actually just live.
Yeah, I think that's the only question is, like, is living at this point to this younger generation, is it as simple as having Netflix and food delivered to your door? Like, is that still living to them? You know, I saw this statistic yesterday where it's like virginity for young men is skyrocketing. And that to me just tells me that, their value system, their way of living is, this sounds like I'm humble bragging, but it's quite different from mine. It's quite different from what motivated me and inspired me to go out and risk take. Like so much of like the male drive in particular is that of courting. It's of, you know, finding mates. And if you're a virgin and you're locked in your house and you're just watching Netflix and you're getting food delivered to your house, see, it creates a very sick society. It's not one that it doesn't reproduce. It doesn't survive. I mean, ultimately this society will not survive if it's on this current trajectory. So for that reason alone, I believe that we will course correct. We will have a counter-revolutionary trajectory of some sort, and God willing, because I refuse to live in a country like this for the rest of my life. So I'm going to find a way, whether I have to go elsewhere or I have to risk something to change it here. I'm going to make sure, damn sure, that I don't live like this for the rest of my life. It's not how I'm meant to live, and I cannot do it. Just yeah. Point blank. I can't.
Absolutely. You know, as I'm thinking about, as you're mentioning, like the young kids who I've seen, you know, like data to back this up, that they don't have sex as much. They don't drink as much. They don't engage like socially as much. And you're right. It reminds me of, you know, when I'll be in these arguments sometimes with like these like woke 20-year-olds who come at me on Twitter about me saying an offensive thing on a podcast 3 years ago. Oh, you made this joke about trans people. This is unacceptable. And I'm just like, whoa, like before, it's almost like my first instinct is to like argue back and right. then be like, yeah, this was a joke I made 3 years ago. Do you not get what's going on here? But then you almost go like, whoa, what is happening here? Right. You're 22. I'm a 38-year-old dad. You're not supposed to be offended by what I said. I'm supposed to be offended by what you're doing. Like, I'm supposed to be like, hey, calm down, guys. This is a little wild. And yeah. then you're going, get out of here, you old square. You don't understand what we... Like, that is the natural order of things.
The young generation is supposed to be coming up with new racial epithets and stuff to, like, really, really throw us off the path. We're supposed to be blown away by the crazy shit they're saying.
But and I just like the racial stuff, but just offensive. I know, in
general. It was a joke. It was a
joke. Of course. But like, you know, it's like this is like, what is it like to be a 20 something year old hall monitor? Like, what are you doing here? You're right. worried about policing offensive thoughts. You should be out there thinking about wild things and then being offensive at times. And then as you get older, refining it a little bit and being like, okay, I missed the mark with that one. This is a little bit, now I'm a little bit more aware of like, and it's a weird thing where they kind of have this attitude, which has been completely like injected into them, that they're like, well, I really care about like the well-being of society. And that's why I'm doing this. And it's like, listen, I've been in my early 20s. You don't give a shit about anything else, okay? You give a shit about your own status, your own life. This is what you care about. You know, like when you grow up and you have a family and you have more responsibilities, that's when you think about these other things more. This is not really what's happening here. Mm-hmm. And it's like, it's sad. It's like a sad, you know, there was this one guy who was just arguing with me literally about a joke I made on a podcast 4 years ago.
Of course.
And in his bio, it said, libertine. And I'm like, dude, you're not a libertine, motherfucker.
No.
Now, I'm not a libertine, but some people are, but you're not. You are an evangelical Puritan. That's what you are. I know you think that you're a libertine or whatever. You're not. You are absolutely boxed in by the rules of the orthodoxy. That is the world you're living in.
I mean, he is technically not, like, for sure.
Yes. So. That is a sad thing to be in your early 20s.
It is.
You know, it's unfortunate.
You're supposed to be taking risks at this point. I mean, not only risks for mating purposes, but also for, you know, discovering yourself, for creating. Like, if you have a culture that stops taking risk in their teens and their early 20s, your entrepreneurial side is toast. I mean, you need people out there that are willing to throw caution to the wind and say, I'm going to go out and I'm going to create. Even though I'm an idiot and I'm young and I know nothing, I have an idea and I'm going to run with it. That is what makes America great, in my opinion, is the willingness to do that.
That's such a great point. You know, I didn't even make that connection, but you're absolutely right. Because that kind of young spirit of risk is exactly what you need to have entrepreneurs and to have any type of success in the economy. I mean, I think about myself, right? Like, I took a big risk in starting a career in comedy, a career in podcasting, all of this stuff. That could easily not work out. And I was well aware of that during the time starting, especially when it wasn't taking off right away. And you're like, very like, okay, this might fail. And, you know, now I could never in my current situation start taking that type of risk. I just couldn't. I have a wife and a daughter who I have to support. So I couldn't take that risk now. I'm lucky I took the risk in my 20s and it can pay off now. But if I was in that same spot now, it's like, well, I have to just go get a job. I mean, I have to do something that's going to bring money and I don't have it. But you're so freed up at that young age to be able to take these big risks in all across the board in life. Yeah. And that's another thing. That's all. It's the woke shit and the COVID stuff. It's all built around not taking any risks.
Yes.
What an awful thing to do to young people.
That's exactly right. And that's why I believe that in some ways this might be intentional, because or it's just a sick shift in society. I don't know. Either way, it doesn't really matter. You know, it really doesn't matter. I don't want to go down the conspiracy route, but the truth is, like, if you create a society, particularly one that's built on capitalism and risk taking, and you break the young population from that mold, if you make them afraid of it, what happens next? I mean, obviously the system starts to have speed bumps and perhaps collapses and things like that, because especially when you're buried in so much debt, $28 trillion in debt, $35 trillion by the end of this year, $50 trillion by the end of this decade, at least. If you don't have tremendous innovation, if you don't have completely new industries, like, we need multiple new internets to have any chance of growing ourselves out of this. If you break the risk-taking spirit of your 20-somethings, God help you. So for our own survival, for our own economic survival, we need to push these kids to continue to do what they've done historically forever, which is go out and be libertines.
Yeah, right. Yeah, right. Like, in kind of in the best sense of the word.
Right,
like,
right.
No, you're absolutely right. All right, guys, let's take a second and thank our sponsor for today's show, which is IP Vanish. Very happy to have them back on the show. IP Vanish has been a longtime sponsor of ours. Great to have them back with us. Let me tell you about IP Vanish. If you care about the security of your online activity, the easiest way to protect yourself is with an IP Vanish VPN. Rated 4.5 out of 5 on Trustpilot, IP Vanish provides an encrypted connection for all of your internet traffic, helping to prevent websites, Wi-Fi providers, and even hackers from intercepting your data. You can keep financial details, personal information, and online activity safe from threats with IP Vanish. Get started with this limited time offer and save 50% off the monthly and annual subscriptions by going to ipvanish.com/problem. One more time, that's ipvanish.com/problem, all lowercase. It's really important today to protect your online privacy. It's only going to become more and more important. I highly recommend you check this out, ipvanish.com/problem. All right, let's get back on the show. It's funny, man. I really, there's one of the things I really got wrong over this last year that I've, I get some predictions right, some wrong. This one I got profoundly wrong. Not like a, I thought Trump was going to get reelected. I was saying that by a slight margin.
He might have.
I was like, could go, right. But I was like, it could go either way. And then it wasn't really till, it was about, I think, a couple months before the election that I really started focusing on the vote by mail thing. And then I was like, oh, you know what? All predictions are off, because this is going to come down to lawyers and no one's going to know. And it's going to come down to who the media declares. And that's obviously Biden. Like, Trump doesn't win that game. Like, but I was kind of wrong, I guess. Maybe. Who the hell knows about that one? But one thing that I was really profoundly wrong about was I thought probably around April of last year that this was the death of the woke shit. And I was really wrong about that. But I was like, you know what? Now, for the first time ever, America's got real problems at home.
Not I remember just, like, that the episode.
Problems, not just the problems we're creating, in third world countries, but now we've got a tyrannical government, mass unemployment. You know, at the time it was like tens of millions of people applying for unemployment insurance every week,
Right.
And I just go, this is going to be a destroyed economy with a fascist government. And this is, no one cares if someone committed a microaggression 4 years ago. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
Man, did I get that one wrong. It's people clung to the woke shit.
In fairness, you were right for a few months. When our cities were burning, people stopped canceling, Kevin Hart.
Right.
I mean, temporarily, people were actually distracted by it. But I think that you are right, though, that when you have a really significant societal collapse, which the truth is, we haven't experienced the economic ramifications of these lockdowns yet. So when we have that, that's when the woke shit will stop, because people will be starving. I mean, because money will not be able to buy the things that you need to buy. And that's when people stop concerning themselves with, did he call me Asian because, all that nonsense. So I think that that's the thing to look forward to in an economic collapse. I don't know if I can frame it in that regard. But ultimately, we don't have to continue on this path like that. As I continue to say, they are the minority. Like, and I'm not a big fan of, like, oh, the majority rules or anything. I could care less about that. I'm just saying, when you're being ruled by a tyrannical minority, tell them to fuck off.
Yeah.
Just say no. Yeah. So that's kind of my stance on it.
No, yeah, I agree with you on that one. It is, you're right that we really haven't felt the ramifications yet. And we're still in this phase where we're, as I remember Tom Woods said on my show once, he was describing Austrian business cycle theory. And he said in the most basic way to put it, he goes like, it's like you're not eating any food. You're just drinking energy drinks. You go, this will keep me going. Don't worry, I don't feel tired yet. And then when you start to feel tired, chug another energy drink. And at a certain point, you realize this has to end with collapse.
Like, you're like,
this
wait, why is my heart hurt?
Yeah, right. And then you start to, you're like, oh yeah, my heart really is starting to hurt. I really feel awful, like violently ill. And you're like, well, chug a couple more energy drinks. And you're like, okay, well, at some point.
I just need a nap though.
Yeah. At some point, you're going to nap, whether voluntarily or not. You know, you're going to be
exactly
on the floor
right.
And sleeping.
No, so that's exactly right.
So that's unfortunately, I think, what we have to look forward to. But you know, it is almost like, you know, as I was saying before, with the ramifications of the 2008 crash being Donald Trump and Antifa and all this other stuff. It's almost like, you know, when you have like a leak in your roof. You know, the water gets in, but you have no idea where this is going to manifest. This can travel all throughout, and you could have, you know, water dripping in your bathroom and be like, oh, it must be right above here, but it may not be. It might be the complete other side of your roof, and it's just like traveled all the way through. And, you know, I was thinking this. I try not to jump on, you know, mass shootings right away. And have like, oh, let me politicize this mass shooting. This is what happened here. And this is why everything I believed before this shooting has just been proven right, you know, and stuff like that. But it's just a thought that entered my head when you see like a couple of these incidents and you're like, yeah, man, I mean, I wonder what the psychological effect of this last year is going to be on the country. And I would be shocked if it didn't manifest itself in some really brutal ways. And I think that's another thing we're going to be dealing with on top of the economic stuff is that we really, anybody who was on the edge of mental health, we really pushed them over this last year. We did the worst things we could for them. And I'm sure all of us know people in our lives like that who were, you know, if you tended toward being a little bit paranoid, oof, man, was this a bad last year for you.
Yeah. Well, for libertarians, I mean, it's a perfect example. We were more radicalized in this moment because all of our worst fears came true. We had a government that was willing to do this to us, even though my entire life people were like, ah, Clint, you're delusional. The government would never do that. Yeah, they fucking would. They did. Like, yeah. I was right. So, I completely agree. I think that you're starting to see the actual effects from this. I'm stunned it took this long. I really don't know how we got this amount of time before we started to see more mass shootings and things like that. It's a miracle in that regard.
Well, but, I mean, you know, look, I've been talking about this for a while, but we did see mass riots. I mean,
oh yeah,
and people can, you know, try to act like those things aren't connected.
Oh no,
but
they were
obviously are, right?
Of course,
like, this was clearly, you know, in large part a result of locking people in their homes and taking everything from them. It's like, totally. Oh, okay, well, we're angry and pissed off, and we're pissed off at everything, the whole system. And they might be yelling racism while they do it, but where you're throwing a brick through a store window, you're pissed off, and you're letting the energy explode.
And for the record, rightfully so. I mean, not that their act was righteous,
sure. Yeah.
But their emotion was correct. They were being screwed over. I mean, to a large extent, your schools were shut down. You were out of work. You have cops. You're being told by the media, at least, that cops are hunting down black people, even though I think they're just hunting down Americans. I think there was genuine reason to be out in the streets and protesting. I disagreed with the message that they were propagating.
Sure,
and I disagree with their solution, but I appreciated, honestly, I appreciated the fact that we finally saw the American people rise up, even if it were for completely the opposite reasons that I probably would be doing it. I was like, well, at least finally people are showing some spirit. Now I'm waiting for the 2A people to do it. When do the conservatives say, you're not taking our guns, Joe Biden? Like that to me is the next big fight, because he floated very aggressively yesterday that he's going to use executive action to go after assault rifles. And if he does that, I mean, if the right doesn't rise up for that, and I'm not saying violence, I'm not calling for violence, but if you don't rise up in a meaningful way, freedom in this country is dead. I mean, that is the most important factor when it comes to remaining free, is to have the right to defend yourself and with a weapon that can actually do something. So if we allow them to take that, forget about it. We're toast.
Yeah, no, 100%. And the, you know, there's a few thoughts that I had on that. Like, number one It's like for the guy who claims his whole thing was about unity and healing the soul of the country. I mean, if there's one thing the left could just fucking let go, because you know it's going to completely, you know, pit the country against each other and tear it in half, is this, go take the guns. But the truth is, and I've said for years that I think that, like, you know, you make these arguments about government seizing guns, and you can, you know, and I say this to just like my normie friends, like other friends who are just comedians, not really politically involved. And if you point out that it's like, you know, like Hitler and Stalin and Mao, and they all took guns away from their people, and these are the most brutal, tyrannical governments, they'd go, yeah, that's true. But there's also countries like England and Australia and examples like this where they don't become brutal, totalitarian, you know. And it's like, okay, that's fair. That is actually a fair, you know, rejoinder. Like, okay, fair enough. There are, it doesn't mean you're going to be living under Stalin or Hitler if the government rounds up your guns.
Not right away.
But I would say this. I would go, okay, well, America, and I used to say this, you know, like 5 years ago, 6 years ago. You go, okay, well, America has the most militarized police in the world. We have the largest incarceration rates in the world. And we have a president at the time, Barack Obama, who just signed into law the right to detain American citizens without charges and hold them indefinitely. So am I really being paranoid that I don't want that government taking my guns away? You know, like, this would be my argument. But now, after this last year, it's like, I mean, I don't know what to tell you. You're going to just let them do all of this, shred the Bill of Rights, and then start disarming people? This is the most appropriate time to be paranoid of what the government is doing in American history.
Yeah. And your point about how they, you know, counter you with Australia of all places, which had the harshest lockdown. It's like, well, right. Maybe had Australians not given up their guns, that lockdown wouldn't have been so hard. And then I made another point online yesterday that, you know, you saw peaceful protest about police violence over the summer, and you saw many of the police brutally beat those protesters. Mm-hmm. And then what did you see? You saw the protesters go out there armed. And what happened then? It was peaceful. Yeah. So I can't imagine after 2020 of all years to still think that you need to ban guns, and that having guns to prevent a tyrannical state doesn't make sense. That argument is dead. I won't even have it. Like, I don't even have that argument with people. But to the conservatives, the ones that are unwilling to have that argument, you better be willing to fight. You better be willing to actually mean it when you say, you do not take my gun over my dead body, out of my two dead hands, all that shit that they've said for all these years. You better mean it. You better mean it.
And to the and of course, this is the thing that's just like the most infuriating about the left. And even when they're kind of good on some issues, they're just so goddamn stupid on this issue of state power that it's just so frustrating. So it's like, so you've had this whole movement over the last fucking year of, you know, racist cops and how terrible the racist cops are. And like, okay, whatever, we can split hairs and get into the, you know, actual legitimacy of the claims, but I'm no fan of the cops. So, okay, you're against the cops. And then, of course, like, whenever it comes to any political action, it's like, and so you vote for Joe Biden. Like, okay, you know, the architect of the incarceral state. There you go. You got him in there. Okay. Well,
but Kamala Harris, too. I mean.
Yeah. Oh, right. Okay. Right. And a cop. A cop who actually locks black people in cages. Right. Okay. Right. Great job. But whatever excuse you want to make about Donald Trump, you had to get the big, bad orange man out of there. It's like, okay. But what you're advocating here, if you start, like, the next round of the war on guns is just more of the war on drugs. It's just more like, what do you think? Do you know how many fucking black people are sitting in a cage robbed of their freedom right now that got 10, 20, 30 year sentences for the crime of owning a gun?
Yep.
Not shooting anybody, not threatening anybody, just having a gun, perhaps the horrific crime of having some bullets in that gun, maybe having that gun and driving across a bridge where that took them from one state to the next. You know, like there's so many of them around the country, just people's lives ruined. And here's the truth, right? Because, you know, like even within these high crime areas, right, within like the most violent neighborhoods in America, the majority of people there are not violent criminals. Even there, it's a minority of people who are actually the violent criminals. And the vast majority of people who live in these high crime areas that are the over-policed ones, you know, or under-policed, depending on how you see it, but the ones with the larger police presence there, they own guns for self-protection, because that's where you need the self-protection the most. And these are the people. Who do you think it's going to be when you have this war on guns, which we already have, but in ramping it up? Who do you think they're going to be targeting? It's not going to be billionaires going to jail for gun violations, right? It's going to be the poor, disenfranchised people. That's who's going to happen. So, you know.
Yeah, no, you're totally right. And that's why, you know, gun rights are a human right. Like, that's really how I feel about it. And if you concern, if you like at all concerned with Black Lives Matter movement, this is the last thing you should be advocating for. Black people don't trust the cops for good reason, especially in those cities. And the reason they arm themselves is because they know that they can't trust the cops to show up when they need them. And they're also surrounded by, you know, lots of crime. So, yeah, I mean, it's the last thing that I would ever imagine a good leftist pushing. And fortunately, there are some good leftists that don't push it. But those are the real ones. You know, those are the real leftists that actually understand what guns are for. Those are the real leftists that understand that the state is not their friend. Kind of the Malcolm X types. And we need that's why, like Magnus Panvidia, my buddy, who's done the circuit recently because he gave this great speech on the Michigan courthouse steps. He's the one that really opened my eyes to how many people on the left still don't trust the government and still value
to
it.
The Boog guy who was on Jimmy Dore's show. Yeah. Yeah, that speech was fantastic.
It was tremendous.
Yeah.
And he came on my show. I retweeted that video. It went viral, had like a million views. And then he reached out to me and he's like, "Hey, I'm the guy." And I was like, "I don't believe it," you know, but sure enough, we have a Zoom meeting and it's him. So after that, he went on to be on Alex Jones and he plugged me. So that really helped me get known as well. But that's not the point. The point is he gave a tremendous speech and he is not your anarcho-capitalist type. Like he's more of a hybrid, more of an anarchist that doesn't really care so much about economics. He'll march right alongside Black Lives Matter people and Antifa. Like he'll march alongside anybody who's anti-government. And I think that, you know, basically we're so outnumbered. I don't actually disagree with that outlook. Like you need to be able to see allies. I mean, we may have our fights down the road, but in the interim, like, we're the deck stacked against us. Like you might want to take some allies that you don't exactly expect to work alongside.
Yeah, no, absolutely. Yeah, I completely agree. All right, dude. Well, look, we're over time, but this was great. We got to do it again sometime real soon. Clint, thank you so much. Everybody, go check out Liberty Lockdown. Just a phenomenal show. It's really become one of my favorite shows out there. I just recently discovered it and I've been binging on it. So you guys go do that as well. And don't forget, by the way, I'll be at Pork Fest and Freedom Fest this summer. Go get your tickets for that. Dude, thank you so much. Let's do this again real soon.
Absolutely. Appreciate it.
All right. Thanks for listening. Peace.